Jewish audio on Chabad.org.
So I will remind you that this class is more about study. And we're trying to study, to understand the words of the Haggadah. And then when we have a better understanding of things, and when we study it better, hopefully we'll also find inspiration as well. But the foundation is simply to study, to understand the Haggadah. In the previous class, we began the narrative of Maggid, narrative of the Haggadah that follows the questions that the children ask. Avodah Mayinu, the concept we were slaves, the notion that we'd still be slaves. And we talked about the sum total of that. And therefore, introducing tonight, we say that even if we are all wise, that even if we are all knowledgeable, it is a mitzvah, it is a moral obligation, and a sacred responsibility, l'saper, to relate, to tell, to speak of Exodus, the story of Yetziyah Mimitzrayim. The Haggadah then adds another point. V'chol hamarbe l'saper b'yetziyas Mitzrayim, anybody who increases, who adds more, who doesn't just fulfill the bare minimum, so the better that is. Reza meshubach, that person is praised. Whenever we have a Torah concept, it remains academic until it is acted upon. Here's an example of this principle. Imagine, if you can, that the High Court of the Jewish people makes a critical mistake in rendering a halachic decision. They say that something that is inappropriate is appropriate, something that is not kosher is really kosher, something that is prohibited is permitted. And you follow what the Beis Din says? You did as you were told. So who's guilty? Who has to bring the offering, so to speak, in the Beit HaMikdash? Who is the one who is responsible? So the Torah tells us that the Beis Din is responsible. That's the simple answer. But then there are nuances. There are qualifications. It's not so simple. One of the qualifications is, if something was talked about, it may still be academic. Until it's acted upon, we don't know that it holds water. There are many scientific theories. The truth is that scientific theory is a bit of an oxymoron, because science, strictly speaking, means knowledge. And a scientific theory is theoretical. It's not knowledge. It's not something we know for certain. A scientific theory means we think it can be demonstrated. So therefore, we have a series of tests. And we have to clinically prove that this theory is, in fact, a reality. How do we prove this? So there are very carefully arranged systems in which we put things through a rigorous series of tests to prove that things are as we maintain or think that they really are. The advertising on television that tells you our brand is better than the next leading brand would not hold up to the litmus test of most scientific inquiry. I mean, they use some kind of inquiry. Who says what the leading brand is? So they buy the junk, and in their eyes, they decide that's the leading brand. How do you argue? Some of the historical theses that are written, revising history, or revisions of that which we have always, truths we have always held to be, are based on shoddy scholarship and sci-fi whacked out ideas that are coming out of nowhere, but that they're such extraordinary suggestions, they have so much shock value that people think, well, it has to have some basis, which is not in fact the case. Halacha is very much like science, like real science, which means that something has to be tested. We obviously do not speak here about things which can be tested in the laboratory. Whether the halacha is or is not so doesn't mean you say, well, okay, it's kosher. Let's try it and see if it works. Let's see if the godliness is activated. Let's see if the electromagnet, if the spiritual energy starts to flow. Obviously, we don't have that. But the Gemara is very scientific in its methodology of continuously analyzing something from all sides, making all kinds of suggestions. It's something like a cross between a scientific examination and between a cross-examination and a court of law. That's how the Talmud relates to every little detail. And yet, We say even when a theory has been deemed to be true, even when we are absolutely certain about something, there's a big difference between it being a theory, being academic, and between it being acted upon. And once it's acted upon, that is the strongest proof possible. In halacha, this is called a ma'aser rav. If the great sage, whom we rely upon, did it, it's vastly different than he said or he wrote about it. If he did it, that's the greatest proof possible. The Haggadah makes two very broad statements, very bold statements, that this telling tonight is not about Jewish education. Education means I'm learning something I didn't know before. I'm acquiring new knowledge. And that's what Pesach is about. V'igadat levincha. You should tell your children. So what if my children are grown up and knowledgeable? What if we all know everything? We're all chachamim. We're all nevinim. We have the right ideas. We have the proper grounding and understanding. So then we can just, it's a mitzvah, so we'll do the bare minimum. And then we'll get back to the things that are more important, to things which are really educational. We'll go back to Torah study. But this is the Haggadah. I mean, like, why don't we talk about some relevant details of our Torah study? We're not suggesting that people should leave the Seder and go to sleep, chas v'shalom, or they should waste time and play cards. But they can do the mitzvah quickly and then go back to what they're doing in general. Which was, for example, the case that the great sages, in the times of the Gemara, spent very little time davening. The greatest of sages spent their time engrossed in Torah study. This principle is called Torato Umanato, which means his Torah study is his profession. That's what he does. And there's even a dispute between the Babylonian Talmud and the Jerusalem Talmud whether one has to interrupt for the recitation of Shema. So generally say the recitation of Shema is biblical. You have to interrupt your Torah study and read the Shema. But when it comes to the prayers, so although the notion of prayer itself is a biblical commandment, according to the Rambam, that the Torah commands a Jew to pray to God every single day, but the times of prayer, Shacharit, Mincha, Marvit, the way we know prayer, that's a rabbinic ordination. And that you're not obligated to do. So if you're studying Torah, you're exempt, technically, from the mitzvah of prayer. So should the mitzvah of Haggadah trump prayer? Is it more important? It's not deep Torah study. There's a famous question that's asked on the halacha regarding Purim. That it says even a great Torah scholar interrupts the study of Torah to listen to the Megillah. So the famous question is, but the Megillah is also part of the Torah. And we know that hearing the scripture being read aloud is a fulfillment of the mitzvah of Talmud Torah, even if you don't understand. That's the halachic distinction between the obligation of studying written Torah and studying the oral Torah. Oral Torah necessitates understanding. Does it make sense? You have to know what you're saying. The written Torah, if you read the words, or if you heard the words read right, you fulfill the sacred mitzvah of connecting to God through Torah study. So the question then is, why do we have to say Mevatl and Talmud Torah? We interrupt the study of Torah in order to listen to the Megillah. It is Torah. Why is Mevatl? Why are you interrupting? The answer is that for a person who could study Torah on a very high level, to sit in a shul and just to listen to the simple words of the Megillah being read, without the depth, without all the insight and the oral tradition that comes along with it, with little children yelling and screaming and making noise, and they say, Haman, it's a waste of time. The time, it seems, could be used in a more effective fashion. And people who don't waste a minute shouldn't have to sit through a 45-minute Megillah reading. So the halacha says no. Because this is important that we remember the miracle, the greatest of sages, the person who is very, very busy with spiritual pursuit, has to interrupt whatever they're doing and listen to the Megillah. So how about the Haggadah? How about the Haggadah? Is this the most profound writing in the body of Jewish scholarship, the Haggadah? Most certainly not. Most certainly not. Much of it is fairly simple. Much of it is fairly straightforward. There are quotations of verses. I'm not saying there's nothing profound in the Haggadah. I'm not saying that we cannot study the Haggadah in depth. I'm saying it's impossible or unreasonable to suggest that this is necessarily the deepest, the most potent body of Torah scholarship that exists. So the Haggadah came along and said, you're a chacham, you're wise, you're learned, you know. And if we have the potential of studying Torah at a much loftier level, So should you sit at the Seder table with the little children? Should you sit and just focus and obsess over these few verses? Or should you finish the Seder and go back to something else? So we said two things. Bold statement number one, we know everything, mitzvah aleinu lesaper. Bold statement number two, it's not just sufficient lesaper, but halchol hamarbe. The more you do, the better it is. So there's no such thing as reaching a quota. Many halachas require a certain modicum, a certain level you have to reach. It doesn't say, chol hamarbe le'echol matzah. There's no mitzvah to eat more matzah than is necessary. So you have to eat a kezayit matzah. Eat a kezayit of matzah. You are the leader of the seder and you have a seder plate. Okay, then you have to eat two kezayitim. Two kezayitim. You want to eat then another kezayit for a korach? Fine. And then for the afikoman, you want to be a mahadrim and a mahadrin, a super Jew, you eat two kezayim. Five kezayim, 5 ounces of matzah. That's enough to give you indigestion, for sure. The strongest of stomachs is challenged. So should I eat a 6 matzah, a 6 ounce, a 7th ounce? You know. How about 4 cups of wine? Taurus is 4 cups of wine. Okay. Can I drink a 5th cup? It depends when. I could. During the meal, I can drink a 5th. How about the 6th and the 7th? Yeah, during the meal, you could. So should we do it? A month late. On Purim, it says, Chol hamarbe. You drink more? Wonderful. That's a good thing to do. On Pesach, there's no mitzvah of eating or eating more matzah or drinking more wine. And there's certainly no mitzvah of eating more maror. Most of us have plenty of maror anyway. The bitter herbs show up in all kinds of forms. You don't have to be machmir or be mahadir. You don't have to be stringent or try to be meticulous about looking for more bitterness. But there is one thing on the night of Pesach that no matter how much we did, we can and should try to do more. What's that? Lesaper, to tell the story. So the burden of proof now is upon the Haggadah. This is at this point a theorem. A compelling theorem, but a theorem. So therefore, the Haggadah continues now with a story. And here's the thing. Really, a story, if we're going to tell stories tonight, which stories should they be? The story of Yetzias Mitzrayim. And instead, we're telling a story that only happened less than 2,000 years ago. A story that's in the post-Second Temple era, the present era, the final galut that we are in now. So why are we telling that story? It almost seems like a contradiction. You just said that you should tell about L'Saper B'Yetzias Mitzrayim. You should tell the stories of the Exodus. We're not saying that other stories of our people are not important. It's important to tell the story of Avram and of Yitzchak and of Yaakov and of Sarah and of Rivka and of Rachel and of Leah. We studied the Chumash. The whole Chumash Bereishis is filled with stories that are compelling and poignant and meaningful and instructive. But that's not the stories we're going to tell tonight. Tonight we're going to focus primarily on the stories of Chumash Shmot, and especially the first half of the Parsha. It's very important to know the stories of the Gemara. Rov Sodot HaTorah Gnuzin Bahem, we are told. The vast majority of the Torah's secrets are encoded, not on the surface. The stories of the Talmud, people mistranslate as legends instead of stories. Legends mean tall tales. Chas v'shalom. There's no tall tales in Torah. There are no legends in Torah. They're stories. And they're metaphors. Many of them are all kinds of deep metaphoric meaning. And they're very important. And there are Jews who study the Agadata, or the Agadah, the stories of the Gemara, on a daily basis. But that's not the story that we should tell tonight. What story should we tell tonight? Yetziat Mitzrayim. So what do we turn the page? And what are we telling about? A story of time of the Gemara. It's like the most anticlimactic thing. You just gave this whole speech about how important it is to tell stories of Yetzias Mitzrayim, and you follow in a story from the times of the Mishnah. So something doesn't fit here. And therefore, the Abarbanel says that at this point, the Haggadah, the Baal Haggadah, feels a need to demonstrate that this, in fact, is the case, that it's not a theory, that it's an instruction. How do we know? Because this is what they did. This is what the greatest sages did. And in fact, the Abarbanel says that the story is instructive on both cases, on both suggestions. The first notion is, afilu kulanu chachamim, kulanu nevinim, we're all wise, we're understanding, we're learned. Mitzvah aleinu lesaper. It's a mitzvah for us to tell the story. Does anybody in this room think that he or she is smarter than Rabbi Akiva? Anybody thinks that they're more learned than Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, who we're going to learn was a teenager when he became the Nasi, the prince, the leader of the Jewish people? Rabbi Yeshua, Rabbi Elazar, the greatest sages. Just the foundation of all oral Torah is built on the backs of these sages. They are the foundations of the Mishnah. And yet, they told the story. The second suggestion was Chol HaMarbe, that you should do a lot of it. So how much is a lot? How much is a lot is a relative theory. Long before Einstein, we had the theory of relativity. It's all relative. For the poor man, $1,000 is a lot of money. For the rich man, $100,000 may not be a lot of money. It depends. But here's one thing that's for sure. There are only so many hours in the night. And so many minutes. So, Chol HaMarbe, what is the extraordinary, most extreme, most vast, big, however you want to put it? Chatzot. Or, and we're going to get back to that point later of Chatzot, which is minute, or all night. You can't tell the story more than all night, because you're only given a mitzvah to tell the story all night. So here we have an actual time frame, and the time frame is exhausted. So that proves, that demonstrates, Kol HaMarbe L'Saper B'Yetzias Mitzrayim. That we know that it means you have to tell the story a lot. How much is a lot? All that's possible. Because by the time they finish telling the story, they actually were going to find that it had to be interrupted. Because it was time to read the Shema. Because they had broken. So that's the preamble to what we're going to study now. That's the preface. And an interesting thing to notice, that the statement wasn't just made that mitzvah laharbot. There's like a period and a new sentence. V'chol hamarbe. What's v'chol? In Hebrew, kol means all. So v'chol and all who do this. Why does she have to say an all? We already discussed that everybody's obligated in this mitzvah equally. We talked about, pardon me, men, women. Everybody's equally obligated in this mitzvah. So why do you have to say v'chol? So it's possible that there were some Jews who were sitting around the table at the Seder whose ancestors were not in Mitzrayim. What kind of Jews would those be? Converts. That my ancestors were in Mitzrayim. So you'll say, well, some converts have Jewish blood. That's possible. And it's distinctly possible there could be a convert that has no Jewish blood. There's a Navajo Indian from all sides. Because people have been living in the indigenous Americas from before the times of Avraham Avinu. There's no Jewish blood there. He's a convert. He's a fellow Jew. We love him and we care for him, even more so than a Jew who was born of a Jewish mother. So says the Torah. But could he say, and my ancestors were in Mitzrayim? So we say, yes, Kol HaMarbe. How do we know? Because there was a great sage, his name was Rabbi Akiva. And Rabbi Akiva was Ben Gaden. His parents were not born Jewish. Ah. So we see then that a ger, somebody whose parents were not in Mitzrayim, he can still tell the story, V'chol HaMarbe. How about if your parents were in Mitzrayim, but they didn't have to work? They weren't involved in the actual slavery, the bondage of Mitzrayim. Of course, you could ask me, how would anybody know? The answer is there was one tribe who didn't work. They were the Levites. Because they stuck with the Torah, so they never ended up working. So how do you know who's a Levite? What do you mean, how do you know? That's the only thing we know today. So the other interesting thing is, says a book called Simchas HaRegel, that in this story, everybody is either a Kohen, a Levi, or a convert. Everybody. And they were the greatest sages of all time. And they spent all night telling the story, discussing Yetzias Mitzrayim. Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Yeshua were Levim. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah is a Kohen. Rabbi Akiva is descended from Gedim. And Rabbi Tarfon is a Kohen. Not a single one of those people could say with any kind of certainty our ancestors were in Mitzrayim, and quite possibly they could say with certainty our ancestors were not enslaved in Mitzrayim. And yet, it's important for all of them to tell the story. And the Chidah says that that's exactly why this follows. So we have the Arbab now telling us the Maaseh Rav on both levels, and the Chidah emphasizing that it's not only the fact that they were wise and that they spent all night, but also their lineage, who they were. onto the story itself. It is noteworthy that this section of the Haggadah is very old, and it's one of the Haggadot of the Gaonim, Reb Amram Gaon, who arranged a Siddur, formulated the prayers, and he also arranged the Haggadah. It's already found in his Haggadah, and the Tosfos mentions it. Tosfos is Mitzayin to Agadat HaPesach. Tosfos is from the medieval sages, Rishonim. So it doesn't say Haggadah, it says Agadat HaPesach. The Rebbe notes that there is no Medrash. He looked at every Medrash, he couldn't find this in any Medrash. Agadat usually means a Medrash. Why is this relevant? Well, it's relevant because this could not have been in the original Haggadah. The Jewish people did not start celebrating Pesach 2,000 years ago. They celebrated Pesach for 1,400 years before Rabbi Akiva came along. So what were they saying on the night of Pesach? Without a question, they weren't saying Maisa, Rabbi Lezer, Rabbi Shua, Rabbi Lezer ben Azariah, Rabbi Akiva ben Tarfon. So at some point, this was added into the Haggadah. Now, it is eminently possible that the statement before was always in the Haggadah, or predated this by centuries. But they added this story in because it was such a compelling proof, as we mentioned, to everything that's being said. Rebbe notes also that in the Tosefta of Psachim, there is a story like this with Rabbi Gamliel, who is a generation later, in Lud. And over there it talks about the fact that they were involved talking about in the laws, Hilchata Pesach, which we'll come back to in a little while, because the fact that they were in Lud on Pesach talking about the laws of Hilchata Pesach means even though there was no Korban Pesach, because it would have been in Yerushalayim, not in Lud, nonetheless, they were still talking about the laws. And even though the laws are not technically relevant, that's still part of the discussion. That's still the currency of the night that we discuss. So, when did the story happen? I will share with you two compelling theories, neither of which can be demonstrated with absolute certainty, but there are the latest theories out there. I mean, ask, what's the latest theories out there? I don't know. This is the latest. People have been doing lots of research and publishing papers on this. So the latest compelling suggestions are that this happened, some suggest, during the Mered Bar Kochva, which is 67 years after the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. And others maintain that it was in an earlier period, during the Roman occupation and the terrible persecution that the Jewish people experienced, which resulted ultimately in the Bar Kochva rebellion. So we know it's either five, six decades after the Beis HaMikdash is destroyed, or 67 years after the Beis HaMikdash is destroyed. How would we know that, and why is that relevant? The answer is very simple. Each of these people was a great rabbinic personality. What are rabbis supposed to do on Pesach? Supposed to leave the congregations behind, leave all the people, and go to a rabbi's convention for Pesach? Of course not. The rabbi has to be there with his congregation. People have shilas, people have questions. It's the busiest time for a rav, is Erev Pesach. The questions he's getting all the time, especially because people are asking about halachas that they're not familiar with. The halachas of, I took my milk spoon and I mixed the meat pot, could happen any day of the year. So it happens, and people ask questions. Here's the thing, chametz is something we deal with only for, say, 7-8 days a year. In Lubavitch, the village of Lubavitch, town of Lubavitch, obviously the Rabbanim could never go away for Yom Tov. High holidays, how could you go away for high holidays? That would be the congregation. Pesach, what kind of Rav does go for Pesach? So the only time they go is Shavuot. Because Shavuot, what could the Shaila be? How many blintzes I should eat? There's no shilas, right? In the old days, there were two professions, if you will, or two callings. There was a rav who paskin shilas. There was a magid who gave sermons and did a lot of preaching. Today, one person has to do everything. But this wasn't always like that. Once upon a time, there were really extraordinary rabbis. So the rav was a mamash, a real rav, and it was a magid, a real magid. So the magid stayed for shvuas, and he gave the sermons and drashas. But the rav said, I'm going to the Rebbe. So they used to call, in Lubavitch, used to call Shavuot Chagam Matzos, because a rabbi in Hebrew is called Moret Tzedek, the one who shows people what to do. So Moret Tzedek, it was like a euphemism, Chagam Matzos. Matzah is Pesach, Chagam Matzos, the festival of Moret Tzedek, that was the only time of year Rabbonim could get away from their communities to be with the Rebbe. How is it possible that five of the greatest rabbis in Israel are now with their congregations? Okay, Rabbi Akiva was with his congregation because he is the rabbi of Bnei Brak. which is not a modern city, by the way. It's a very ancient city. And it's mentioned in the book of Joshua. It's mentioned, we talk about the cities around the area of Dan. And Bnei Brak is mentioned, one of those cities. So it's an ancient city. Rabbi Akiva is the rabbi. Okay. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah is the Nasi. The Nasi. He should be with the Sanhedrin. Rabbi Eliezer surely has a post. Rabbi Tarfon has a post. How did he end up together for Pesach? So that's where these theories come in. This is a very unusual time for the Jewish people. And during the Bar Kochav rebellion, people weren't sitting home. There was no normal Pesach. And we know that Rabbi Akiva and many of the sages were on the side of Bar Kochav. Rabbi Akiva, the Rambam tells us, was his arms bare, whatever that means. He humbled himself before Bar Kochav. He believed he had the potential to be the Mashiach. So the rabbis were together. This was maybe in a military situation. And these rabbis, in the middle of a war, in the middle of a revolution, Pesach is Pesach. The Seder is the Seder. And they sat down to discuss, Atshubo Talmideim. Others have this fascinating theorem that they have to go to Rome to plead the case to the Jewish people, and that they somehow just made it back for Pesach, and they got stuck together. So that's how they were together. At any rate, whatever theory we'll accept, and we'll probably never know for sure until Mashiach comes, what is, I think, extremely relevant and important for us to know is that we're talking about a very difficult time for the Jewish people. We're talking about a time of persecution, talking about a time of exile, talking about a time of pain, time of deprivation. But that doesn't take you away from Pesach. Pesach is still Pesach. And the Seder is still a Seder. And Yiddishkeit has to continue to be observed. And we don't have to go back to the times of Bar Kochva, or the Roman persecution for this. We all know stories. And if you didn't hear firsthand, maybe you heard from somebody else, but we all know stories of people during the Holocaust years who baked matzah, who had a Seder, who risked their lives. Some of those stories have happy endings. Some of them tragically do not. But one thing we do know for certain, that people continued to observe HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Torah. In best of times, HaKas V'Shalom, when the times weren't so good either. So that's a subtext in the story of itself, just the historical context. But going forward to the story now, the next thing a scholar would want to know is the order. Really, you don't have to be a scholar for that. Whenever people have a list of names, what's the most simple way to list all the names? Alphabetical. Why? Politics. Why is my name second? Why is my name third? It's simple. It's not easier. You list names wherever you list names. It's easier because people give you a hard time. Who is the most prominent? You know, mirror, mirror on the wall. Who is the most famous of them all? This way, alphabetical. Nobody can have any tinnitus. If your name starts with a Z, that's your last one. You're not offended. Your name starts with an A, and the second letter is B, so you're on the first one. Nobody has any complaints. So how did this work out? First Rabbi Eliezer, then Rabbi Yeshua, then Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, then Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Tarfon. First of all, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah is the Nasi. He's the leader of the Jewish people. So if he's the leader, he's the head of the Sanhedrin, which the Rambam says in Mishnah Torah, that the Nasi of the Sanhedrin is b'mkom Moshe, that he occupies the position of Moshe Rabbeinu, so then why isn't he listed first? So the answer is going to have to be, well, there's seniority over here. Well, if the seniority, Rabbi Akiva is an old man. Rabbi Akiva, we have to figure, was killed in the Roman persecutions. We know he was 120 years old. He had to have been older than Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah significantly, decades older than him. And he comes after him. So the Rebbe says that Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah is before Rabbi Akiva, because Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, there was two things, two special qualities that he brought to the table, which Rabbi Akiva did not have. Number one, he had something called lineage. There's a certain virtue, value to pedigree. He was 10 generations from Ezra, who was like the Moses of the second coming, who's the one who led the Jewish people back into the land of Eretz Yisrael. He is the one who presided over the Sanhedrin, who hammered the body of Sanhedrin into what it was supposed to become. He created Anshe Knesset HaGdola, and their bequeathment to us is Judaism as we know it. The Siddur, the Haggadah, the blessings, all of Jewish liturgy, all of those basics come from Anshe Knesset HaGdola, led by Ezra the Sofer, Ezra the Scribe. So he has heavy-duty lineage.
We say he's a Kohen. He's a very special person.
Number two, he had a position. It doesn't matter who was older or younger. He was the Nasi. Since he was the Nasi, that's why he goes before Rabbi Akiva. So in other words, Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yehoshua, they are Rabbi Akiva's teachers. And they're older than him. Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus was a primary teacher of his. So as such, that makes sense that seniority came first. But then after seniority, we had to go to Rabbi Eliezer ben Azariah, who's the Nasi. And then came Rabbi Akiva, and Rabbi Akiva comes before Rabbi Tarfon. Why is this? Because Rabbi Akiva is the Rav of Bnei Brak. Rabbi Tarfon was older than him, but Rabbi Akiva was the Rav. Now Rabbi Tarfon was a Rebbe of Rabbi Akiva's. He was a teacher. But it is said that Rabbi Tarfon at some point was no longer a teacher, but eventually a colleague. And because he was no longer a teacher, but he became a colleague, that's why Rabbi Akiva is listed first. So now we understand why the Gemara tells us it's important to know halachically Rabbi Tarfon nasa chavero. He was his teacher. The Gemara says he became his friend. The Rebbe suggests that there is an interesting idea, a halachic etiquette, which is talked about in Masechet Brachot. We actually learned it together. That there's a way you're supposed to be seated. There's the leader, and the way these reclining kind of couches, recliners that they used to eat on, were set up. So it says that you would have to have the Godel Be'emtza, the senior figure at the head, and then it says Lemailaloi on his head, where his head is, and then Lemataloi, where his feet are. In today's day and age, we can arrange that with right and left, but today you're sitting upright. In those days, we talk about the idea of reclining. So therefore, it turns out that we're going in a circle. We start with Lemailaloi. Who was on the right side? Who was at the head of Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah? Who was the Nasi? Was Rabbi Elazar Rabbi Yeshua. In the middle, we have Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. And then, Lamai Lamata Mimenu, on the other side, on the left side, which would be at his feet, there we have Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Tarfon sitting. Now this approach explains to us why Rabbi Elazar and Rabbi Yeshua are placed before Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. Because if Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah has the virtue of being the Nasi, and of being this high pedigree, more so than any of the other sages, you would say he should have gone first. Well, according to that approach, he did go first. He did go first. And it does say the word mesubim. Mesubim comes from the word heseba. Heseba means to recline or to lean. All right. So now we understand when this is happening. We know with who this is happening. And we understand also why they're listed in a particular order. And we also know that there's no Korban Pesach, because if they're in Lud, or they're in Bnei Brak, not in Yerushalayim, we're in exilic times, and yet they're discussing the laws of Beis HaMikdash. Now here's something interesting. You mentioned before, the time is still Chatzot. Why did you say the time is still Chatzot? Because everything is connected to the mitzvah of eating the Korban Pesach. And the Korban Pesach's time expires at Chatzot. So if so, it would seem that the time in which the expiration of all of the mitzvot, including the mitzvah of L'saper B'tzias Mitzrayim, when would that be? That would be at Chatzot. Says the Rebbe, even though Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah are of the opinion, as is documented in the Mechilta on Parshas Bo'i, and in the Gemara in Pesachim on page 120, that Achilas Pesach is only till Chatzos, nonetheless, we see that they still continue to talk about the mitzvah of Yetzias Mitzrayim. See, there's this whole issue whether Til Chatzos is Lechatchila or Bidiavad. Is it you have to, ideally, in a perfect situation, have concluded everything by midnight? Or is it good if you continue, if you didn't finish, you can still move along with the mitzvahs of Pesach until day breaks? So it seems Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah and Rabbi Eliezer say no. Chatzos, that's it. That's the cutoff point. Yet clearly they would continue to discuss and talk about the laws of Hilchos Pesach and talk about the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim a whole night long, even after the Afikoman. So this was a dry run. There was no more wine, there was no more matzah, they weren't eating anything anymore. But they continued to sit around the table and to talk about Yetzias Mitzrayim. So you're asking, why are we talking about the laws of the Korban Pesach? We should be talking about Yetzias Mitzrayim. Guess what? In the Haggadah, we are talking about Yetzias Mitzrayim. I just told you about a similar story, which took place not in Bnei Brak, but in Lud, where they were talking about Korban Pesach. So why would they talk about the Korban Pesach and not Yetzias Mitzrayim? The simple answer would be that the observances of Pesach night are connected to the Exodus. But, in fact, you can't really ask the question because I'm only mentioning that in passing. The Haggadah actually is concerned with your question. And the Haggadah that we read tells us the story of the sages discussing Yetzias Mitzrayim, not the laws of Korban Pesach. So, Hoyu Misaprim B'Yetzias Mitzrayim Kol Ha'Yisya Laila. They're telling the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim all night long. So why did they stop? Achibo, Talmideim v'amru lehem. And there their disciples came and they said to them, Rabbeinu, our masters, higi azman kriya shma shel shachris. It's time to read the Shema. Now, what kind of disciples are these? They're coming and giving advice to the Rebbes. Why wouldn't the Rebbes know it's time to read the Shema? And if you have to read the Shema the first second, they're involved in Torah. It's Torah, Torah, Menot, Torah. So they'll read the Shema in a little while. You had to interrupt the conversation. You had to stop this. If you would see they're going to lose the time of Shema is one thing. But you had to come in to the point of interrupting them. There are many answers that are given. So I want to share with you like more of a little bit of a mystical insight into this. That's based on a talk of the Friedrich Rebbe and later elaborated by our Rebbe. When we talk about Yetzia Mitzrayim, going out of Egypt. Our mission is to personalize this whole tale, this story, this experience. That we are not merely recounting a historical event, a once upon a time situation. We said it before, we would be slaves ourselves. Now, we discussed this previous class, we would be slaves. How would we be slaves? What does that mean? We talk more of a spiritual concept of slavery. We talked about the idea of us not being a people of God, not having the ability to rise above limitations, as the Maharal of Prague explains. So now, making this even more personal, Hasidus emphasizes that every one of us has a mission, has a need to transcend limitations. Let's talk about limitations. Some people will have limitations of patience. They don't have endless reservoirs of patience. They say, okay, yeah, it's too much already. I'm losing my patience. That's a limitation. Maybe if you'd have more patience, you'd be able to deal with this person. So I have my limitation. Another person says, I think I'm ADHD. I don't know what I am. I can't pay attention. I can only listen for my time, you know, my attention span is 6 minutes, and then my mind starts to wander. So that's my limitation. Another person, they say, my limitation is, I'm not really comfortable socially, so I don't want to be with people. I want to be away. I want to be a loner. So you're supposed to be together with people. Well, that's my limitation. Limitations are things which limit us. They don't allow us to fully experience life or to fully experience Jesus Christ because we have our limitations. It could be a phobia. It could be laziness. But it's my limitation. One person's limitation is not another person's limitation. But everybody has to see themselves, kilu hu yatsu mimitzrayim. So if one person to transcend that limitation is an extraordinary event, that's for them. For you, you have to do your yitzia mimitzrayim. And Chassidus says this is the whole essence of Avodas Hashem. This is the meaning of serving God. This is the meaning of transcending self, of not getting bogged down in who I am, of being able to realize the potential of who I could be. which is necessarily going to be labor intensive and is going to be difficult, and it will necessarily require you take the path of greater resistance, just about always. In fact, almost as like a sidebar, there's a famous comment in the Gemara that everybody should have a mitzvah that they really work at. It's called Zohir Tvei, that I'm very meticulous about. And Hasidic thought says, Zohir comes from the word Zohar. My soul should radiate. I should become filled with light for this mitzvah. So, very nice. How do I know? I'm not a prophet. I don't have spiritual intuition. How do I know which mitzvah is my special mitzvah? So the Hasidic master said, the mitzvah that's really hard for you to do, that's your special mitzvah. Why? Why? Why does whole wheat bread have to taste worse than white bread? Why does candy have to be unhealthy for you? Because life is not a bowl of cherries. Hashem wants us to work for it. Hashem wants us to earn it. And the Yetzirah is the force he puts in place to trip us. So the Yetzirah, if he sees that you have the ability to achieve extraordinary something in one area, where will he put all his strength? Into that area. Think about it. This is basic counterinsurgency. I have to try to figure out what my enemy is going to try to do. And that's where I'm going to put my forces. Like when the Allies invaded Europe, they had all these false maneuvers in another place. So the Germans put all their reinforcements up in Holland and somewhere else, and they attacked them from what was seemingly a weaker entry point. So the Yetzirah is going to think, okay, I'll let the person do mitzvah A, mitzvah B. That's not their special mission. But mitzvah C, I'm throwing all my forces there. I'm going to get them to stop that mitzvah. So what do you have to know? You have to know, A, that's probably a sign that this is your mitzvah. And B, you have to know that if it's your mitzvah, you could do it. You could do it. You can over... That's Yetzirah Mitzrayim. That's going out of your Mitzrayim. And guess what? When you go out of Mitzrayim, a day later you're back in Mitzrayim. Because that's your new limitations. Now you have to go beyond that. And we have to go Michayel El Choyel, from strength to strength, always transcending, always going beyond. So Hoyu Misaper B'Yetzias Mitzrayim, the word Misaper means to tell. It also comes from the Hebrew language of Evan Saper, a luminous stone. It's a luminescence. Hoyu Misaper B'Yetzias Mitzrayim. They were trying to ignite themselves, trying to fire themselves up, trying to find inspiration in a time of such difficulty. It was a time of despair. If this was the Bar Kokhba rebellion, it was almost over. Because there's another historic opinion that says that the tragedy of Rabbi Akiva's disciples was actually the decimation in battle. That 24,000 disciples were killed right after Pesach. From Pesach to Lag BaOmer. Or from Rosh Chodesh Iyar until Erev Shavuot, until 3 days before Shavuot. But the 33 days in which all battles were lost, if that opinion is correct, means that they're sitting here on the eve of what they are probably aware will be the end. They know that there's just no way out. They're sitting mamish Erev Tisha B'Av. The worst is about to unfold. And they were despairing. They felt somehow they couldn't lift themselves out of this depression. They couldn't lift themselves out of this darkness. And they were misaprim b'tzias Mitzrayim. They're working on it. They're trying to get out of the night. Kol oisei halayla, the whole night. They're trying to break out of night, out of darkness. And they weren't successful. They couldn't. They somehow couldn't stimulate themselves to get the spiritual juices going. Until what did it? Atshebo Talmidei. The disciples came. And the disciples said, our holy rabbis, we want you to know that you inspired us. Higiyaz man kriyash mashal shachris. You have broken our night. We find ourselves now ready to read the Shema, ready to accept Malchus Shemayim. We find ourselves at shachris. And the message to them was then, that even if you feel that you haven't found a way to ignite your life, you should take satisfaction and have nachas. You have stimulated us. You have inspired us. And that's what your job is. You're a Rebbe, you're a teacher of Torah. So that's what this is about. That this is about, that it's all about, the focus is on bringing light to somebody else. And oftentimes when people want to know how to break their own depression or sadness or difficulty, you know what the best advice is? Do for somebody else. Put a smile on somebody else's face and then you will smile. Bring happiness to a broken soul, and you will feel holier. And that's the message over here. The Rebbe takes a Gevaldike twist on this. He says, what's the whole Pesach about? It's all about education. V'igadta l'vincha. But they were so engrossed in trying to tell the story and find inspiration that it's almost like here they're missing the point. You know, like they're focused on this. We're not succeeding. And the Talmidim came along and said, but you are succeeding. Because Pesach is all about the next generation. We're ready. We're standing by. We are all inspired. You inspired all of us. That's the message of Pesach. So this story, from this prism, from this perspective, it's not just a question of Maisedav, just demonstrating and proving that this story is the essence of Yetzias Mitzrayim. This story becomes a defining moment in what is the night of Pesach about. It's about the others. It's about the disciples. It's about the children. It's about the grandchildren. It's about the individuals whom we have to work on to inspire. And that's where our inspiration comes from too. So at this point, the Megillah now continues, and it says, Amar Rebbe Elazar ben Azariah. Rebbe Elazar ben Azariah says, now, the Rebbe notes in his commentary in the Megillah that there are some versions of the Megillah, the Haggadah, that says, Amar Lahem. What does Amar Lahem mean? He said to them, which would indicate that this little piece, this teaching, is one of the teachings that we glean from that night. From that night. Amar Rebbe Elazar ben Azariah, Amar Lahem, Rebbe Elazar ben Azariah said to them. And the Rebbe says that even if our Haggadah doesn't have that terminology, if that word is missing, it doesn't mean this is not connected. In all likelihood, he says, yes, this is a continuation. It may be in a separate paragraph, but that is a continuation. Ma'aseh Rebbe Elazar. So, and what did they talk about? They talked about Yetzias Mitzrayim. The need to talk about Yetzias Mitzrayim. The central role that remembering the Exodus plays in our Avodat Hashem in our lives. So Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah begins with this incredible statement, he says. He's incredulous. Hare ani kiven shivim shana. He says, I'm like 70 years old. V'lei zachisi, and I did not yet merit. And the Rebbe says there's two ways to understand zachisi. The simple way, and zachisi is, the way the Pirush HaMishnayos is, I didn't merit. I wasn't gifted by Hashem with the ability to understand this. But the Bartanura says something different. When you have an argument, to convince the other side is the one-upmanship, to deliver the knockout punch, that's called zachisi. I'll prove to you that I'm right. So Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah is saying then, according to the Bartanura, it's not that I'm not sure. I knew I was right. I was convinced beyond a shadow of doubt that this is the case, but I couldn't prove it. I couldn't find the words. You know, sometimes you're absolutely convinced of something, but somehow you're not finding the words. That, oh, finally. And he says, that's what you meant. Now I got it. That's called Leizachisi. Leizachisi means I wasn't victorious like. I didn't overcome my debating adversary. So Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah says, from any way you want to look at it, whether he didn't, on that clarity with himself, whether he wasn't 100% sure, or he wasn't able to demonstrate the clarity for others. But at any rate, he doesn't know Shatayama Yetzias Mitzayim Balelis, that you're supposed to remind yourself and speak of the Exodus at night. Achadrasha Ben Zoma. Until Ben Zoma comes along. And he says, it's true, it says, Laman Tiskers Yom Tzeischa Meretz Mitzayim. But take a careful look, it doesn't say just Yom, it says Kol Yimei Chayecha. So you remember all the days of your life. Kol Yimei Chayecha, he says, Yimei Chayecha, the days of your life are the days of your life. Kol Yimei Chayecha. This is Lahavi, this adds Halelos, the nights as well. So before we comment on that, two things. First of all, what's the background here? What does it mean I'm like 70 years old? What does that mean? Where's that come from? How, why, when, what? Number one. Number two, once we all know the story, then becomes the next question. So what's the meaning of that? The story is that there was a leader of the Sanhedrin. His name was Rabbi Gamliel. He was presumably, according to most opinions, the son of Reb Shimon, who was the son of Hillel. Shimon was a weak and ineffectual leader, great tzaddik, but he didn't have the charisma of his father, of Hillel. And Reb Yochanan ben Zakkai stepped in. Yochanan ben Zakkai was considered the smallest of the disciples of Hillel. Yonas ben Uzziel is the greatest, he's the smallest. You can imagine what the disciples of Hillel were. And he became Rabban, he became the Nasi, during the period when the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. During the most crushing moments and uncertain moments of the Jewish people. But after Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's passing, the Nasius reverted back to the family of Hillel, who had a Davidic connection. Through his mother, he was a descendant of David the Melech. So Rabbi Gamliel becomes a Nasi. And everything that Rabbi Shimon, who was in the Mishnah referred to as Shimon Benoi, not Rabbi Shimon, Shimon Benoi, who lived in his father's shadow always, that he had a soft personality, a meek personality, he was unassertive, Rabbi Gamliel was the polar opposite. He was overly assertive. And he was so assertive that the sages couldn't take it anymore. He was so strong in his leadership. And the story goes that the Rebbe Yeshua, you mentioned over here, was once forced to do something that he didn't want to do, that he believed was wrong, but Rebbe Gamliel says that's the halacha. And he shamed him publicly to demonstrate. So all has to be discussed and understood, but not for now. But the bottom line was, the sages said, this draconian discipline is too much for us. The Jewish people will not be able to flourish under such strong and harsh leadership. He said there needs to be a softer approach. So who's going to do that? Who's going to displace Rabbi Gamliel? They don't know what to do. So there was a young man, and there are different opinions. The most common opinion in the Gemara on Daf Chav Ches is that he was 18 years old at the time. According to other opinions, the Jerusalem Talmud, the number 16 is given. Avud Raham lists the number 13 of Bar Mitzvah Boy. But the common approach is 18 years old. Extraordinary person. It says he had all the virtues. He had inherited lots of money, so he didn't need anybody's money. His lineage, Ezra Sofer. That's base, second base on Migdash lineage. Doesn't get better than that. That's, you know, the latter day Moses, so to speak. He led the Jewish people back to Eretz Yisrael. And he was brilliant and learned and wise. He had all the virtues. Says that's it. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. We're going back to the before Hillel days when there was Ezra. We're taking Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. So he came home. He said, I have to discuss with my wife. His wife said to him, you're not going to get any respect. You have a black beard. So the story goes that night he went to sleep, as they say, to sleep over it. And he woke up in the morning and there were 18 strands of white hair coming through his beard. So he said, oh, a miracle like that? That's it. He said, this is a sign from heaven, and he accepted the Nasius. In the end, the Nasius was shared. It was a rotating position that was shared between him and Rabbi Gamliel. But Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah brought enormous changes to the system of Torah teaching, which have left their mark for posterity. So that's the story with Harei Ani Kiven Shivim Shana. I'm like 70 years old, he looked like 70 years old. So the question on the question is, why is that a question? In other words, he's saying, how could this be? I'm like 70 years old and I don't have the wisdom. So what would you answer? Because you're not. What do you want? You're like 70, he's not 70. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah is like, I don't understand this. I'm like 70. So you would say, yeah, that's right. When you'll be 70, you'll know the answers. Now you're just like 70. So we're clearly missing something over here. The Rebbe asks another question. He says, tell me, all the sages, they didn't understand this. That he wouldn't have respect because he wasn't. The sages made the suggestion. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah himself didn't know it. Until he came home and his wife said to him, "This masach nanish, what are you talking about? You're a kid. It's not going to work." Only she thought of that question. It wasn't discussed. Nobody thought of this. It was perfectly normal for them to appoint an 18-year-old to lead the Jewish people. Something doesn't make sense here. So the Rebbe says, for sure, they had discussed this and they knew that it wasn't an issue. They knew it. They knew that he had the wisdom, that he was like 70. But when his wife brought up the issue again, she said, but still, you don't look the part. So a miracle happened that was indicative of an internal reality. In other words, this is based on the premise that everything that happens in the physical, in the flesh, is a reflection of the spiritual reality. If Rebbe Elazar ben Azariah had a miracle that he looked like 70, then this was merely reflective of the truth that he was an old soul in a young body. And that miraculously his body looked older too. So they knew that the body didn't conceal what was inside. But really he was Taka 70. The Arizal says that this is connected to Sayyid HaGilgulim, this notion of reincarnation. It's true, none of you have ever lived before, as you are. And don't worry, you're not going to have to fight over the body with somebody else when Mashiach will come at Chiyas HaMesim. But we are connected. We are all here, and we've been here before in various incarnations, and there are various soul sisters or soul brothers that we have over the ages. Even a zivug, the right zivug, can be two halves of a single neshama. We hope that we're zeicha to that. That's what we hope for. But there's this notion of kindred souls. And it's possible that a neshama of the past should somehow become linked to a neshama of the present. You know, they have this new technology called the iCloud, where you could link in to information that's not actually on your device, but you're able to access it. It's like a spiritual iCloud thing. So the previous Gilgal, which I believe it's brought down with Shmuel HaNavi, who lived 52 years, you add 52, you add that to the 18, what do you get? There he goes, 70 years. In other words, he was able to access a database that was outside of his own immediate knowledge. He got a high-speed download. In one night, he downloaded 52 years who was missing, with all the prophecies, with all the intuition, with all the wisdom. He says, that's what he says. So indeed, I really was wise. I really was like 70. So why don't I know the answer yet? So finally, Ben Zayma, who by the way was a very young person, he had the answer. So we understand this on two levels. Either that he was 70 because Yitaka was 70, and that miracle merely revealed the fact, or because on that night, he got the iCloud connection, and then he became an old soul. So Lahavi, it doesn't just say L'Rabba is to include. It says Lahavi. What does it mean, Lahavi? Lahavi means, I can bring Yitzhak B'Tzayim into the night. It was the time it's yoyim, it's light, it's day, it's bright, everything is fine. And I have to look for Yitzhak B'Tzayim. And then it's the time and it's night. And Ben Zayma says, even in the night, you can bring Yitzhak B'Tzayim into that. You can still be transcendent. You can still go beyond. The Chachamim came along and said, no. Yimei Chayecha Ha'olam Hazeh. The days of your life refers to this world. Kol Yimei Chayecha. The extra word, Kol. That tells us that we will even be able to find inspiration when Mashiach will come from the Exodus, from Yetziah Mimitzayim. Now the simple question is, do the Chachamim disagree with Ben Zoma? Ben Zoma says, Kol Yimei is Lahavi Alelis. The Chachamim say the word Kol is Lahavi to include Yimei Samashiach, the future reality. So, are the Chachamim of the opinion that you have to mention Yetziah Mimitzayim at night? Some of the commentaries in the Mishnah say that's correct. The Chachamim disputed the opinion of Ben Zoma. They said you don't have to mention it at night. Others explain the Chachamim are not disagreeing. The Chachamim are adding. They're adding. And they're saying everybody agrees you have to mention the Exodus, Yetzias Mitzrayim at night. This is brought in by the Shalah, by the Tzlach, the Neid Behuda, and others. But the Rebbe says, even according to the Shalah's interpretation, that the Chachamim are adding to the opinion, there has to be a difference of what they held. So what is the difference? So the Rebbe says, according to the Chachamim, the mitzvah of remembering Yetzias Mitzrayim by yoim, by day, ubalayla, and at night, are one mitzvah. That's one obligation. That means kol yimei chayecha, yimei includes days and nights. So then what's the kol? The kol includes the second detail. Now, how would you get from Yimei Chayecha, days and nights? The Rebbe says simple. They would liken it to Kriya Shema. Kriya Shema has to be recited during the day and during the night. And the metaphor and mystical messages, you have to be accept Hashem's obedience in the morning when you're starting off in life, as the Sefer HaChinuch says, and when you get older also. You always have to have that obedience. Or as written elsewhere, in times of goodness, in times of light, times of easiness, times of struggle, times of deep personal challenge and difficulty. You always have to say the Shema. You always have to be able and ready to accept upon yourself the yoke of heaven. So this idea of Yetzias Mitzrayim, you always have to find that transcendence. So the Chacham say that's one thing. It's one thing. But what you should know is that even when Mashiach will come, we will still find inspiration in the miracles of Yetzias Mitzrayim, of the Exodus. That's how incredible the Exodus was. that it continues to resonate with eternal relevance. Not only relevance even when it's bad or dark, but with eternal relevance. And with this, the Mishnah concludes the narrative that demonstrates everything we learned earlier. And going forward, now we're going to begin to discuss, going back to the Haggadah, the style that has to punctuate tonight, the not monologue, but the dialogue. The education that engages, that inspires the children, the parents, the educator, the benefactor, and the pupil, the recipient,